Professor Walker's practice exam on 21st
I'm going to go to the next one. Okay, take a look at the sample answer I just passed out, and then we'll talk about the exam and whatever you want to talk about.
Should we ask a question about the answer?
Sure.
Let me just say a couple of things about the exam.
This is a very typical instruction page. On the other hand, you know, if I decide to make, I haven't even thought about this, so always read the instruction page carefully. Don't assume you know what's going on. Notice, and this is again very typical, my exams you saw in the old exams on file. Each question answered in one side of one blue book page, if that using blue books. If you're on a computer, that takes 100 characters.
Does the character count spaces or without spaces?
Yes, they tell me it does. Yeah. I saw the sheet they passed around to you that Gary Moore sent out with the equivalents. You know, if you take the exam on that, that counted it. Spaces for characters, so I assume that's it. Notice also very typical of the exam on the note at the beginning of the. Any questions about the that first page, the format, the instructions, the open book? The note at the top of the first page of the exam, answer each question independently without assuming anything from your answer to the other questions. I'm just suggesting that when you do another question, start over in your head. Don't think that something you answer in another question somehow constrains what you're doing in this question. In fact, if you, I would hope that it wouldn't. So maybe you're not thinking about it correctly. If you think that the two are somehow tied together, or maybe you are and I'm not. I think you're better off if you start each question with a clean mental set on what the problem is. And of course, what I'm trying to guard against is you assume something from something else, which messes up your second answer if that turns out to be an incorrect assumption. And then you compound this problem. Base your examination only upon legal materials and theories discussed in this course. So if you have something, you know, if you get something from criminal law, set it aside for the course. What I expect you to have are the pages assigned from the textbook and the parts of the concise case statement that we either talked about or are triggered by those pages from the textbook. Mr. Tripp, did you ask me about the vicarious liability? There were some pages that back when we did race assign that you read about vicarious, those were assignments just like every other assignment. I assume you know that material is to cover it systematically in class. But it wasn't like the material that I said, you know, read it for convenience, not like that. That obviously is more miraculous now that you see it. Treat all legal issues raised as issues of first impression. That means don't think that you're governed by any precedent. Of course, that means you use the restatement, you use any case law you have as persuasive arguments to talk to the court into adopting a rule or whatever. So, question one. Typical question again. Be sure you pay attention to the motion. Who's making the motion? If you have multiple defendants and you have a motion against one of those defendants, I really mean it's only a motion by the plaintiff against that one defendant. I think that it's broader than it is. Maybe I have cut off part of the problem that I might have written because I know the space limitation. So I'm trying to get it down to the size when you need to deal with it. Don't undo that by reading it more broadly than it is. And sometimes, I think in the second one, you know, I ask you in the end, summarize the arguments about the res ipsa argument. I don't mean the, and I mean not the other arguments. Just tell me exactly what I'm, stay focused on what I'm asking. And in this one, the motion for summary judgment by Luckless, against claims by Luckless, based upon the theory that your client is legally responsible for injuries caused by Duwall's negligent conduct. This is not a motion about any theories of the negligent conduct on the part of Smith or South. So that's another example of it into the scope of the motion. Also, very typically, this kind of instruction, summarize the arguments filed by the plaintiff, and it's very typical that I only give you one side, but that it summarized the arguments, and that's what you see reflected in the sample answer, what I mean by a summary of arguments. So, let's talk about this.
One thing, I saw Restatement 425 mentioned in one of the cases, and I wasn't sure whether I should note it because it wasn't. It's not in the shorthand, so I didn't know if I should rely on that or not. If we see another restatement in our notes that isn't in the book, I guess it's okay to use it, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Not if it's Restatement First.
Right.
But we had one, the negligent entrustment case we just did, right? What was it, 309 and 390? The restatement sections where you have them in the, if I'm remembering these numbers even roughly correct, they're in the textbook. They're not in the concise summary. Well, that's fine.
Yeah.
You still use them. 308?
In your answer, how can you talk about the at Otero case where they used 422? Say that once the landowner regains the possession of the land, he is liable for completed work. That's what I talked about. So you can use that answer. I don't want your answer.
Once
the guy finished cleaning the deck, it was a landowner's responsibility. Once he got it back, you know, the guy independent contractor was out of the picture at that point.
Right. Right. Well, let me just, I mean, without going back and looking at that one precisely, when I will, this is a sample answer. It's not a model answer. I go out of my way at the beginning to say, I really mean there's a difference here. A sample answer is one that a good answer might look like. But you can be thinking of arguments that never occurred to me. In fact, I don't know if I've mentioned this to you, what I like to do to make an exam is make it about a problem I've been thinking about and giving it to you to see what you think about it. So I've got some ideas on how, you know, this would go. You have some ideas. When we talk to about grading, I'll show you how that gets factored in, but absolutely. It's not a model answer in the sense of this is the answer. If you didn't give all these things, you're in trouble. And if you gave other things, I disregard it. It's not like that at all. It's not a model answer. You persuade me that this is a good argument. And let me know enough what you're thinking. I mean, that's another reason that, you know, I've told you, you don't have to cite cases or rules. But here's a good example of when you're in a very short thing by saying, what is it, 422, or the plaintiff's name in the case.
And if you do that, give me a page number. I mean, just help me out a little bit here. So I can go back and look at that and see what you're thinking. And then that gives me background when I read your argument. And I'll see whether it makes sense to me. Absolutely.
But this, the format on the sample answer is okay. We can do just like 1, 2, 3. We don't have
absolutely
to do a full essay.
As opposed to what?
Just like a full essay with, you
know. Oh, wow. Why would I want this? I want to see.
I want to see
the reason. I want to see the reason. Notice the way this is the way this is set up. Look at that sample answer. While we're on this. In opposition to defendant's motion for summary judgment. So there you have who you are, what you're doing, and this is as much for you as for me. I mean, I wrote the question, so I know what the question is. But honestly, to spend that number of words at the outset very briefly to remind yourself and make yourself check what exactly is the motion, who brought it, and what's the motion saying, so that it helps you keep on track in the rest of the answer. Stay focused, and it won't hurt. Spend a few words to say exactly what it is you're responding to. The plaintiff has three arguments why a reasonable jury could find Smith liable. So you're arguing in opposition. It's all about this should go to the jury. Deny the motion, go to the jury. I've got three arguments, all leading to the same conclusion. You give the conclusion first. A reasonable jury could find Smith liable for injuries approximately caused by Duhall's negligent conduct in this accident. Why repeat the conclusion three times at the end of each argument? As multiple lawyers do, we start with the conclusion, and then we give multiple lines of reasoning to the same conclusion. It's economical, it's efficient, and then you give your summaries of the different lines of argument. Notice another thing. I mean, while we're talking about the form here. Number one starts with the rule, uses the evidence in the case for why it's sufficient evidence, right? Keep an eye on the motion. It's about whether there's enough evidence for a jury to get the case and decide, in this case, this argument that it's vicarious liability. Number two. Rule, evidence, then policy arguments for the rules in one and two. Is that why repeat them? Now I know in the and what you should see here is an example of what in legal writing you call a paradigm. Two examples of a paradigm, I think, efficiently put. I mean, what you have, you have different terminology. Rule proof, right, which is policy arguments for, as I understand it, why the rule should be adopted, or the authority behind the rule. Then you have rule app, which, as I understand it, is the same as, you know, what, this context, we have enough evidence to set it for trial. On that rule. So what you see here in, I think, a fairly compressed, summarized form is a couple of complete arguments. The summary of the arguments. Of course, the reason. Then number three, quite aside from those two special rules, there's just the argument that there's sufficient evidence for a jury to find that Smith had right of control. And so actually, the contractor was not independent, but was really an agent
or in a master-servant relationship. So you don't even need vicarious liability. Well, is there any evidence of that? Well, you know, she called him up. She kind of, you're going to argue, fine. A reasonable jury could find she took control of the operation with regard to the mirror specification. Maybe not everything. About that. So, four men. 1, 2, 3. And the goal is to summarize arguments given the motion, all leading to the conclusion the motion should be denied. And you think of as many as you can. Because the motion should be denied if any one of these the court buys, right? Any one of these.
So, when we're writing our rule, like whether it's like the restatement or the prima facie case or something, do we have to lay out what that is, or can we just do that in our app, like for the showing?
Well, it's a very nice question, and for one thing, especially if, for example, you tell me a number or a case, or if you say a prima facie case for negligence, and then you zero in on the part you want that you need in your argument, that's fine. Because you've told me what the context is. Now you zero in, and you're absolutely right. Sometimes, instead of stating the rule in general form, and then the next sentence actually applies it, plugging in the, you know, the plaintiff and defendant and so on. In this case, just do it once. You know, it's an instantiation of a general rule, especially if you tell me, you know, under the rule such and such, there's sufficient evidence that Smith such and such, and then you're putting in the operative language of the rule in the context. Yeah, you can do that.
How problematic is it if we don't mention a specific restatement? We say what it means. We get the essence of what it says, but without the specific mention of it.
You can have an A answer without mentioning any numbers or cases. But, having said that, there are efficiencies for you to do it. Like you can tell me where you're coming from with a context, and then when you zero in, and let me add, since you said, did you get the essence of it or something else? Where did you get that essence a little wrong? And so you tell me a rule I don't recognize. I said, well, that's not a rule I ever heard of. But with a little more context, or maybe that's enough context, I don't know, it all depends case by case. If I know where you're coming from and I think you just, you know, misstated something slightly, that's one thing. If I think you came up with a rule that I've never heard of and I don't know where it came from, you know, and I just can't place this, well, then you're in more serious trouble. The burden is on you to persuade me that there is such a rule, and this is what it says. And I'll do my best to figure out what it is you're trying to tell me. But you have to help me out here.
I know you weren't supposed to, but it just happened to somebody did, or on another type of question. If you went off the subject and started talking about the person was inviting you and you talked about their personal liability, you lose points, or you just get points.
It's possible that you can tell me something so irrelevant that I start thinking you really don't know what you're talking about, and you can lose a point. But for the most part, that doesn't happen. For the most part, you punish yourself by taking up time and space with something irrelevant.
Somebody can go about this whole answer by talking about they were inviting them for different purposes.
Oh, yeah. Wow, that'd be terrible, wouldn't it? Oh. I don't want to say, well, what would the argument be?
that you're arguing they're personally liable, you're not arguing that they were liable.
Oh, I see. All right. This is really off point.
Yeah.
Okay. I was thinking that there might be a way to make this a relevant argument. So the question is, what if you spend all the time on something that, on reflection,
their liability by saying they're
right on something that's a wrong answer, right? That's a problem. It's not quite as bad, but almost as bad as saying nothing. Never skip a question. I don't care how confused you are, you have to say something. You're an attorney, right? You stand up, you say something. That's what you do. So you never just leave it blank. If you leave it blank, there's nothing I can do for you. There's no benefit of the doubt I can give you, nothing. Whatever you tell me, I'll evaluate what's going on there. Especially if you spend all your time on something that is non-responsive to the answer. I have to look at it and see what I can salvage there. But it's a very good reason for not putting all your eggs in one basket, for making multiple arguments. Not only do I encourage you every way I can to summarize as many arguments as you can think of, but also then if you get one of those, you know, totally left field, you've got one or two others.
Since we were talking about motion to dismiss, I went through the evidence of negligence and established why
all of them.
All of them. I mean, I discussed
all of them.
Briefly. I mean, that wasn't my whole answer. But I also didn't talk about being an invitee, which apparently I shouldn't have done.
What did I? Maybe I invited that. What is the?
I talk about the liability of a business owner to an invitee from damages of third persons. I said that I thought part of the demotion business would be that you would argue that the harm caused was not due to, or was due to these other two people.
Mm-hmm.
Funhouse mirrors, and that would be your argument why you would say dismiss this case. We're not liable. It was these two idiots running in the hallway. So my argument for Luckless was, even as a business owner, you're still responsible for third parties on the premise of your business. I mean,
you gave me some of the argument for Luckless. Why would you do that?
Was
summarize the arguments filed by the plaintiff in opposition to the motion. I definitely don't want to know anything about what Luckless is going to argue on this motion or in the case.
Luckless is the plaintiff.
Okay. All right. Luckless. Bye.
We were supposed to be
come on, help me out here. So, right. So, Luckless plaintiff summarized Luckless arguments in opposition.
It was our motion to dismiss, and we're describing her argument against our motion.
Yes.
So I mean, I did talk about how many
all the other elements of the confrontation case that weren't even at issue in the motion.
I talked about establishing a duty.
Don't do that.
But isn't that what
the motion is not about? The whole confrontation case. It's about one issue.
But the motion doesn't tell me that there wasn't a claim made, right? That there wasn't a claim.
No cause of action.
Yeah, cause of action.
Then you would go through the element saying that there
was.
It wasn't about legal responsibility for injuries caused by.
And it was to dismiss.
Against your client that were based upon the theory that your client is legally responsible for injuries caused by Duwall's negligent conduct.
So you're thinking that Luckless is going to produce evidence on all of the elements of the prima facie case against Jewell and vicarious liability?
Yeah, if you establish vicarious liability, you can have an established prima facie against Jewell. If you haven't established one person negligence, then how can there be vicarious liability?
No. It's a great question.
You're already saying that.
It's a great question.
Duell's negligent conduct. You basically said that conduct was negligent.
That's what I intended to say. I mean, that the issue is, and I should have worded it better, I guess. If Duell is negligent and negligently caused the accident, assuming that, then. Can Smith be vicariously liable for that? Yeah. I'll have to think about that. That's why, I try to make these as precise as possible. If I don't, now, you wouldn't spend all your time on all those other elements, right? Okay. Okay, then, all I can say is I hope when that kind of ambiguity occurs and you respond to it and I'm reading it that you get onto the key point and that I recognize that. Interesting. All these years, it's not come up. but now that it came up, it's nice. I like it.
My question regards to more question two, or I think it applies more to question two, but how do we reconcile when we have, you know, very different, like different jurisdictions handle things differently? With rest of the restatement handles it differently than each requirement, and the jurisdiction regarding burdenships and all of that are very different. How would we reconcile that in this argument? I mean, do you say if it's this particular jurisdiction, it goes this way, if it's this jurisdiction, it goes that way?
Yes. Now, in this, little drill thing, if this were the exam, I would be trying to do one of two things. Narrow your question by telling you, and Recipsa, of course, is a nice example, right? Because there are two sets of conditions, and it could be a permissive inference, presumption state, and so forth. So it's a nice example. Either I want to narrow your question, in which case I would tell you what kind of jurisdiction you have, or it's a case of first impression about what the list should be. And so if you're going to win or lose depending on which list, it's like any other rule split, and you have to argue for it.
Would you want to?
In which case, I wouldn't be telling you.
Okay. Now, would the same limitations would be, do you realistically be able to argue for one and against another, or do
yes.
you argue for one? Do we have to do both, for one and against another? If say this is first impression, I want you to adopt Eaton and not restatement, do you think I have space to argue for Eaton and then also argue against the restatement, or is the argument for Eaton sufficient by itself?
Well, if I left it open for you to argue, it's because I think you have enough room to do it.
Okay.
So it's a nice example. It's a really nice example and a really nice question. And what I try to do is focus you on the thing I want you to talk about. It might be choice of rule. It might be mere application of one rule, in which case I should be telling you, this is the kind of jurisdiction you're in.
where there's a presumption with the burden of production shift.
Do I have enough room to argue for a rule and against a rule? It would depend. It would depend on the amount of space you need. That leads me to my next point. The lists are the same on condition one. So taking up, you know, suppose you're talking about two rules, this one or this one. Don't take up space writing out all of one and then writing out all of the other one. We're talking about summarizing the argument. What's different between the two that matters in your case, and what's the arguments for going in one direction as opposed to the other? So get right to the heart of it. Now that's also part of what I'm testing, is your ability to see what the real problem here is here. And get to it and resolve it and not spend time and space typing uncontroversial things, right? They're not operative in the argument. You're going to have a tendency to do that. You're going to have and the reason? Because it's that way in your notes. You're going to say, okay, autopilot. This is race episode, so let me type out the conditions. Well, what if the case isn't about all the conditions? Then, as Ms. Anderson said, I mean, it's one thing to take two sentences and say, this is not about whether this is the kind of accident that ordinarily happens, or whether the, you know, the plaintiff, you know, it's about condition two. Well, let's get to that. But I mean, that's an example of letting me know concisely that you know what the risks are and you know what the problem is. So let the ear walker, I get to talk about these things, but I'm summarizing. So the real problem is this, and let's get on with this. That's what I want you to do. You don't have to do all that typing to show me that you know every word in the rule. That's not the problem.
In those kind of arguments with the plaintiff, can you just say something as simple as the Eaton rule would benefit the plaintiff more in their statement to this
assessment? Yeah, actually, right. Where it's something that we've gone over in that kind of detail, I think that is apparent. Right. Rule versus restatement rule, and then move in on the part that matters and policy argument. I think that is fair. If it's, but now, things we've been doing in the last week or two, there isn't just one black letter rule and there's other black letter rule. I mean, they're all over the place on variations on the rules you can have. So there, don't assume that by, you know, recipient bystander rule, you know, Dylan thing, or and all the variations, that somehow you conveyed something unambiguous to me. Whereas I think by telling me the list of conditions in Eaton, you told me something unambiguous.
Yeah, I have a question. Can you infer anything from here that's not on here? Like, if I want to talk about the residents, but
evidence?
I want to talk about control, let's say, or something. And I want to say, obviously, with a name like Reckless, the guy. Can I say anything because you called the guy Reckless?
I wouldn't if I were you. No. You can't make up evidence. I mean, this is a little. But you've seen the fact that you've seen the real exams, right? The reason that this is so short is, I mean, so you can get down to work and do something in, you know, 50 minutes. But the real thing, it takes you. Would take me, I don't know, 45 minutes to really digest the information. 5, 6, 7 pages long, so and so, and this deposition, and that deposition, is this evidence? No. You know, difficulties and ambiguities slip in, but I spend a lot of time on the exam taking out the things that
is so that what's left makes the problem harder. And if you start explaining away the problem by throwing in some gratuitous piece of evidence, I'm not going to be too pleased about that.
Right. I said, with a nickname like Reckless, he has to be righteous.
Doesn't pass the last test, though. Making fun of somebody's name. Convicting them on their name?
Well, I figured you got the nickname from somewhere.
Oh, it's a nickname?
That's what I figured.
No, it's an old Anglo-Saxon. Correctly pronounced Lucas. What else? Anything you want to talk about the second question, or should we talk about grading? Well, let me talk about grading. You can just ask anything you want at any point, right? So, what do I do? Oh, wait a second. Let me see. Here's some notes over the years. If you're requesting a jury instruction in your answer, you have to write out the jury instruction. I don't mean all of it, but I mean the operative language. The jury instructions are about language. If the problem is to request a jury instruction, then tell me what the jury instruction says that you want. Policies are important if a rule is controversial. Now, otherwise, you know, I don't need policies for the five elements of the prima facie case of statement. Never forget who has burden of production and persuasion on the issue that's at issue in the motion. Sometimes, very often, the correct resolution of the motion has to do with who has burden of production on the contested issue. I can't read your handwriting. Oh, okay, this is a transition to the grading part. You'll see when you get the exam, and the exams will be available, you know, by the time you get back. On the top of the answer, you'll see something like, you know, here's question one. You'll see something like 6 + 1 at question one, and you'll see that for question two, and, you know, just question three, and that will be the raw score. And then for the exam as a whole, you'll have a letter grade. The exam as a whole. Now, how you decipher that, what that means, this is the 6, the first number, is the what I think of as the content score. And this one I think of as the coherence score. This is my tally of the you know, number of things you told me. But then there can be usually plus or minus 1, sometimes 2, but plus or minus 1 as coherence. And that's the... I started doing this quite a few years ago, but I realized that there's a real difference between an answer that somehow manages to tell me 6 points worth of stuff, but in a terribly disorganized way, compared to an answer that just proceeds through very logically, but ends up telling me the same amount of stuff. But I'll tell you what, being able to write that second way, the logical exposition, will stand you in immeasurable stead as a lawyer. That's really the thing worth learning how to do. Information, you look it up, you get some wrong, you do better next time. But being able to put it together coherently. And so, on the one hand, you know, you're just learning how to do this, so this coherence score shouldn't swamp this one or even come close. On the other hand, it's my way of telling you what I thought of the coherence of your answer. So between me and you, when you go back and look at the exam, this is one that's very important in my mind. Most of you will just be, you know, plus zero. And that means average. Broad average. Just this is the kind of thing in terms of coherence, layout, progression of the thoughts. It's the kind of thing that's very typical of you at this stage, you collectively at this stage. Plus one means this was really good. You know, in the top, I don't know, 10-20%. This is really well organized. The one that you really need to pay attention to, if I were you, is the minus one. I mean, you actually did lose a point because how you said it was so bad. It's this kind of thing. If that's how your brief would look, this is the summary, right? If that's how the brief would look, I would think, you know, a judge would stop reading long before the end. Just couldn't take it anymore. It's pretty hard to win when that's what's going on. Okay, so how do I get these numbers? When I make the exam, I will go through and think of possible arguments that I can for the answer. So I will come up with something like a sample, not a sample answer because this is nicely laid out, but I think of, you know, it could be this argument, could be that argument, could be that argument. And so when I go to read your exams for number one, I've got some list of arguments. That I could think of that would solve this problem, this litigation problem. And then I start reading your exams. When I read your exams, I will read all of question one first, and then all of question two, and all of question three. It's partly so I can stay focused, partly so, I mean, one of my concerns is that I, much as possible, I'm grading you on the same scale as everybody else. And if I read, you know, one exam front to back, then the next exam front to back, it's hard for me to develop a real scale for question one. And it would take me days to get from exam one to the end. So there's going to be lots of inequities, I think. So, between the space limitation, there's 34 of you. I probably in, you know, one day, two at the most, I can do all of question one and have it kind of breaking in my head so that I'm treating you equitably. When I start, I will assign, you know, points. Some of these I think might be more critical. You really should make this argument. But here's another one, here's another one. And so these are the content points that I go in with. Now here's where, if you think of an argument that I didn't think of, chances are really, that in the amount of space, you replaced one of these with yours. And so I take that 2 points, and if you convince me this is a good one, you get that one. Right? I mean, you had a substitute. Fine. It's conceivable that you did all those and you came up with another one. And that would be fantastic. I'd figure out a way to reward you for that, too. Generally, I don't have to worry about running out of points in terms of rewarding you for what you say right because of the thing that I do next. So, everybody see what's going on here? So, when I do question one, I come up with the content points, and then I give this very subjective, you know, coherence. A plus one is very, actually a plus one and a minus one coherence, very easy to see when you're reading these. A plus one means, it really comes out this way, it doesn't mean you followed all my order or all of the same arguments, you could have made substitutions and so on and so on. Whatever the content points turns out to be that you've got in my mind. A plus one, a really coherent answer, is one that I really have to read through only once. And I say, well, that's so clear. That's so clear. A minus one is, after I read it two or three times, I still don't know what your brain looks like that produced this. And that's what worries me. It's, you know, it's the neuronal disorganization that worries me. That's the minus one. Oh, also with the minus one, because I'm actually taking off a point, it's you made a lot of points, but you actually presented it so poorly that you detracted from the force of your own argument. And that can really happen. So we go through, and then I do all of question two. Oh, and question one and question two could have, question one, I'll decide what an A answer is. Why do I not have any?
It's right there, Professor.
Where?
On the wall.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Question two. Let's say it was possible to get 10 content points. When I start, I think, well, an A. I'm the arguments I can think of, an A answer, 10 content points plus one. 11 points, A answer. Question two might be 7 points plus one. All depends on, the number of arguments you can think of and the sort of priority among them. It doesn't matter because these are raw scores. When I'm done with the exam, I will go through and question one and 11, 10, 9, 0. I'll go through and see how many got how many points. Question 2. 11, let's say, and very possibly, nobody got 11 points. Somebody got 10, 5 people got 9, and so on down here. It's possible to get 0. That's what I have to give you if you have no answer. But then question 2 is only the maximum is 8, 7. So we get a distribution here too. And that's when I assign, when I see how you did. This is the check on me. If I gave you a question and I was thinking, I could see 11 points here, but nobody got 11 points, then obviously there was something wrong with the question, so probably in a case like this, I would make this the A answer. that's the adjustment that you as a group have on my grading. Something about this answer. On the other hand, over here, you know, what I expected, A turns out to be there were enough people, and so that's the A. I also figure out then what's the C. C is the grade below which you should not pass. Right? That's pretty low. But this is per answer. Then the three get averaged. Because now what this does is convert the raw score to a letter score per answer. And then I just average the answers. And that's your grade. Now, when you get back in January, there will be available for you the exam. Your exam, I mean the exam itself. Your exam. Copies, and Joyce will have a packet. Joyce will have a packet. In that will be a copy of the exam. She'll give you your exam. And you can take it out and study it. And please do. Please do. I mark up your exams a lot. You can tell from the squiggles and the question marks the places that I got puzzled. I didn't know what you were talking about, or where you made good points. So I'm talking to you on the exam. You know, I might as well do something while I'm pulled up with these papers. and so you have the exam, you have your exam, you have a copy of the sample answers I used to do the grading. You will have copies of at least one or two of your classmates' answers for question one and for question two. You know, anonymous. No numbers, but just the text. So you can see it isn't just me. You know, somebody, some one of you actually wrote this. And, you know, some of you will recognize your own handwriting or typing. What else will you have? You'll have this distribution. You'll have a sheet that tells you the raw score and how it converted and the distribution. So you can see, you know, if you got 9 on this question, there were only 5 of you that did that well. So you have a sense of where you were in the class on that question. And you can check my math. I mean, at least you can go back, look at what you got there, and look at what you did, and where did Walker get these points. Actually, in the left-hand margin, you'll be able to see where I thought you made this point, this point, this point. So you can reconstruct the grading process. See how you did overall. At a minimum, you're crazy not to do this, because this should be a learning experience for you. On how well you did compared to others on this exam, your writing, your coherence. There's a lot of feedback here. And what else? And then you'll see the overall final grade distribution. Not by name or anything. I mean, how many got A's, how many got... What is it? Because this is a small section, the grading curve doesn't apply in detail. It's something like that. In larger sections, there's a certain percent, only a certain percent can be A's, and so on. So the grades, we have, at least at the tails, we have quantitative guidelines. Not guidelines, but quantitative rules. But I think in here, because it's a small section first year, I think there's just a class mean grade that's specified in certain ranges. And then once you get the exam, you look it over, you want to talk about it, Joyce will make an appointment, and we'll sit down and talk about it. Okay.
That's the problem. Oh, I see. I see. I mean, I always listen. I always discuss. I don't think I've changed the grade in 20 years. Here's this is what usually happens. Not this crisis is not. I'm going to sit down and we'll go over the exam to see, you know, and I'll read through the answers and I'll tell you, well, okay, let's read this through. So at this point, and I'll tell you, like, you know, at this point I'm thinking, well, does this person mean this or this? Or where are we going with this? Well, why is that sentence here? And so it can be a very productive process. In terms of convincing me that you know, as much attention as I paid to this, I just got it wrong. Of course it can happen. Of course it can happen. But we have to look at it and talk about it. Anything else? Yes. What do you mean? Can you write on the
exam? Yeah.
Oh, the thing they hand you?
Yeah.
Sure. People can do that. Sure. Can I just ask a question on question two?
Yeah.
Is it typical that you would do? I can't remember. Both sides within the 300 words.
Not so much anymore. I might do it.
Yeah.
But actually, you know what I figured out over time is when I see one side, I know what you think the other side is. So over time, I caught on that that I didn't have to do that. Well, if you argue in opposition, you're showing me what you think the arguments for are, because those are the ones you choose to oppose.
And so you don't actually expect us to write both out?
Oh, if I tell you to, then you do.
Okay.
I thought what you were asking was, how common is it that I ask you to do both sides?
Yeah.
And I said, over time, these days, in recent years, pretty rare. But if I tell you to, it's for a reason, I'll do it. If I don't tell you to, don't do it. And that's for a reason, too. You've got to need so much space.
And we have to see the phone size on the microphone space limit as well.
If I ask you, right.
Yeah, you just
another question Mike was talking about reckless using stuff that he said in his deposition. That's not put into evidence yet because they motion for Jurassic subject at the end of the so that would have just been based on space.
Exactly. That's why this motion was proposed to the
plaintiffs.
Like I say, the only thing, and you're absolutely right, the only thing you had to work with was what the literal
So then you think, in making any of those arguments, I use anything from reckless imposition, not give me to
because you lost track of what you had to work with. I'm the wrong one to ask. What an expert. Joyce. She's there and knows what gets passed out.
They love it.
I just thought I should ask before I go.
Absolutely. You should ask.
Okay.
So she told you she would.
She told me unless I was prepared to not get a job because of it, I should take it out. And she said even if they let me wear
I should
take it out in court because a judge may tell me to.
So she sees it as... very little upside, but possible downside, depending on the person, and you'll never know. Yeah, that's the other thing, and I can see why she would give that advice. You never, ever know what the person across the desk is thinking about you. I don't care if they're smiling and shaking hands. You never know. You'll never know... why you did get the job. You'll never know why you didn't get the job. So it isn't as though you can have three interviews and say, well, they went fine. I mean, I at least am sure about that. That is not a sample that she tells you anything because you don't know what they're thinking.
Okay. All right. That kind of helps.
But her advice, once you explained it to me, I can understand why it makes sense.
Okay.
But I certainly don't know.
When I interviewed after undergrad job, because I've been out of school for a while, I just interviewed with it, and then it was, I got the job. It was just assumed I'd wear it, but I didn't know any legal profession was different.
Because there you're not only talking about the person across the desk, you're talking about what that the culture of the place that that person knows and you don't. So the person might be thinking, might be thinking not about themselves, but about the person three offices down. Right? I mean, you never know.
I know.
You never know. So I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I won't take any more time. I just
couldn't be helpful in the end.
See your opinion as well. So.
Okay.
I'll just keep going until I get the one I want, I guess.
Professor Monk, I just wanted to. We're never supposed to use any graphic examples to help these people.
What?
Graph in the answer.
You mean make a drawing?
Like you have in this.
Right? Yeah, no. Never. I wouldn't. I wouldn't.
Take one damn second.
Yeah. No, I mean, it would use it to get your own thing straight. But I don't know how you
read it. Our answer, like, in the practice of
me. See, in a blue book, it's a space thing. And you'd be taking up space. And you don't want to do that because the words can get you a lot more. On the computer, I don't know how you'd do it. Because you don't have a graphics capability, I assume, on the software. So, no, don't do it. All right. Okay.
Would I be able to do something next week where if I looked at the test exam and turned it out?
Yeah. But Jack talked to Joyce. And it has to be, you saw my note, it has to be before the last class.
Yeah.
Which gives you basically 3 days. Wednesday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And I'll give her some times.
Okay.
She might be gone by now. But the thing to do is send her an email.
Okay.
And when you do, tell her what times you're available.
Okay.
That'd be the quickest thing. And then she can match us up.
Okay.
If possible.
Okay.
It is kind of late.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. Thank you.
I just really quickly, what I said before, like, if it was an open-ended question, discuss the
the person's negligence, whatever. You want
never.
To say, no. Let's say it was about a specific issue. I'm trying to say. And you,
okay.
To me, I was thinking the guy's name. I was thinking that if it was negligent entrustment, I was even thinking it would just be negligent to entrust a car or a gun or anything to a person whose name was reckless. So if I started talking about that, if that's at all, even for a couple sentences, would that be stupid or no?
Would it be what?
Would it be stupid to do?
No, I think that's too harsh. But it's unwise.
Okay.
Unnecessary.
All right.
I go with unwise.
Okay.
Okay.
You're not going to have enough space to write that anyway. I'm telling you. That's enough.
If your name is reckless, I want to give you my car keys, you know?
That kind of hunch stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got some serious arguing to do.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.